Accession number 28361, reel 53.
General Julian Thompson, reel 53. You were saying that the system of communications from Fearless back to Norfolk wasn't very good.
No, it was a very indistinct
satellite.
It was a sort of first generation satellite communication called SCOT,
yes.
And it didn't work terribly well, and half the time you couldn't hear what was being said. It was like sort of talking to someone, you know, like that, and it was terrible. And I'd had a number of conversations with them when they were. Talking about sort of moving out and all that sort of thing, and there was a stage where I don't think I earned many marks for myself by saying to Dick Trent, who was a 3-star who'd been drafted in as the sort of army element of Fieldhouse's headquarters when Jeremy Moore moved away, I'd rather sort of said, implied that they were being lent on by the politicians,
yeah.
Which was perhaps naughty of me. I don't think I earned many marks. Anyway, I then, and to get, of course, to this satellite communication, I had to either go by helicopter or by boat, and even to get to Fearless during these sort of rather boring nightly conversations, I'd have to go by boat to her, which was a trip across, it would take you an hour back, and you know, it was. And at one stage, they said they'd like a twice daily conversation with me on the SATCOM at their time, 8 o'clock in the 8 o'clock in the morning, which was an hour before they had morning prayers, and again at I think it was 5 o'clock in the evening before they had their evening prayers. Now, being behind them, that meant 4 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock and sort of 11 o'clock in the morning. So I declined to do both, which again I didn't, I think, earn me a lot of marks. I said, at 4 o'clock in the morning I was asleep, and I wasn't going to get up especially, because it was, you know, I needed my sleep. And secondly, at 11 o'clock in the morning I was out visiting units and wasn't going to make a special trip to come back and have a chat with them. Going to the satellite communications set up in Ajax Bay was quite a bore too, because we had to get in a helicopter and go there, because it was a very old, not old-fashioned for the time, but now old-fashioned setup, in that it was pretty immobile. Once you'd set up this great SATCOM thing, which had a dish about half the size of this room, and
a microwave,
you
know, was it?
Micro, I suppose it was. Mm-hmm. You weren't about to move it very easily, mm-hmm. because it took about 15 trucks, and there weren't any roads. So getting
they take up a fair amount of power.
That's
as well,
right.
Don't they?
And so it was there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went there and found myself talking to the CNC, who said, you're to move out of the beachhead. So I said, right. And he said, and you're to take Goose Green. I said, do you mean you want me to capture it? And he said, yes. So I left.
CNC, this would be Fieldhouse.
This is Fieldhouse. He's the task force commander.
So Fieldhouse has given the formal order, you are not just to raid Goose Green.
Yeah, you
are
to capture it. Yes. And he is Fieldhouse is the task force commander. Under the setup at the time, remember,
yes.
that Woodward is not the task force commander; he's a task group commander.
Mm.
So, in somewhat of a bait, I get back in my helicopter and go back.
And I seem to be getting a bit bad tempered. You've got H. Jones in a bait because he can't capture it, and you in a bait because you've got to capture it.
Anyway, so I go back, and some of my staff and say, "Oh, group in whatever it was, a couple of hours."
Yeah,
and I then say to, I send for H and say, right, it's on again, you're to do it, but you're to capture it this time. And at the same time I say to the CO 3 power 4-5 commander, you are to start walking to Stanley. And I told them both originally to go via a place called Douglas Station, which is in the on the side of Teal Inlet.
Yeah.
And but it actually makes more sense for one of them to go straight for Teal Inlet, and there's a route from where Hugh Pike is on which and when I say a route, I mean there's a track This is not even a track, it's a sheep run.
Yeah.
Which takes you...
Sheep walk.
Via there.
Yeah.
So he goes straight there, and Andrew Whiteley with 4-5 are told to go via Douglas, because we heard, actually, that the chaps who run away from there were there.
Well, they'd gone to Douglas.
They'd gone to Douglas.
Yeah, in fact, so you needed to tidy them up.
Need to get rid of them, tidy them up, and then join up. So they start... they're told to start doing that. Mm. And so the Goose Green operation is on again.
So you've got, effectively, you're advancing on divergent axes.
Absolutely.
In the face of a superior enemy.
Exactly. I've got Goose Green down there, I've got these guys coming here, and by this time I've got an SAS squadron sitting on Mount Kent out here.
Ah, yes.
Which is a help, because that means that at least there's someone that end for these guys
keeping an eye on
what's going on. And remember, I've got my recce still on
your
the ground.
My recce
screen
you
still out.
You also have the possibility of a relatively modest Argentine force as a threat on your left flank as they're advancing.
Well, yes. I mean, this is the remnants or rifle company, which I'm not worried about all that much. And 4-5 commander can sort them out. Mm. You know, it's one company versus half a company. Well, sorry, three companies versus half a company. So I'm not too fussed about them. Mm. But I'd like to sweep them up. I don't want to leave them there.
No, I mean they might not be effective in combat, but they might be a nuisance.
They
on
might
them,
be a nuisance. Indeed. So let's get rid of them.
Yeah.
But the main battle that's about to happen, of course, is now Goose Green. Mm. So two para set off.
Mm. What did you know about what was at Goose Green at that time?
Not much. We thought there could be anything between a company. Mm. We knew it was an air base there,
yeah.
And it turned out that there was, but information about what was there was very scanty. Mm. We didn't really know what was there.
Of course, and hadn't you got info from the welfare telegrams about the Orbat at Goose Green?
The welfare telegrams told us there was a company there.
Oh, they did?
Right. Yeah. And that's what there was originally. Mm. They then reinforced it with two more companies, but from different regiments. To an Argentine, a battalion is a regiment. Mm. So there was a company there already, and they reinforced it with two more rifle companies, both from different regiments. So effectively, we had three rifle companies there in the end, all from different regiments.
Can't have done much for their cohesion.
No. Commanded by a lieutenant colonel who'd been sort of sent there. But the most of the guys out of the 1,500 garrison of Goose Green were airmen. There were 1,100 airmen there, because it was their primary alternate airfield to Stanley.
Yeah.
So H and his merry men set off.
What mood was he in then when he set off?
Oh, quite a good mood. He asked me for the CVRT and I said he couldn't have them. Because my worry was the CVRT would get bogged down somewhere between San Carlos and Goose Green. It'd be their sitting target for the Argentine air, sort of sitting in a peat bog. And then I was actually taking counsel of my fears, and I was quite wrong because it wouldn't have happened. The ground actually is pretty rough down there, because a lot of these inlets here doesn't really show on a chart really what this is. To walk down from Sussex Mountain like that, these inlets go quite a long way in, and there are some deep gullies,
yes,
as deep as this room, and with sheer sides.
Square-sided
sort of gullies where peat has crumbled away.
Sound like wadis.
They're rather like wadis, exactly like wadis, all along here. And though there is a way round, I mean, I just didn't want these things to go belly up in that area. So on the first night he walks down and he lies up in a place called Camilla Creek House, in and around a place called Camilla Creek House, which is there.
Yeah.
And then he spends the whole day lying up, hidden, sending recces out. And that night, three guns plus ammunition is flown down. Again, you can't fly in the daytime because all these slopes here are visible from here.
Oh, yes, it's forward slope, effectively.
It's all forward slope. So if you start flying helicopters, these chaps here realise you're doing it. Mm. And that's why the battalion walked down in the night and lay up all day. that very night, or that day, is the day that the Argentines attack our logistic, our forward logistic base, and blow up all the ammunition that's being is waiting to be taken to Para's guns and mortars.
What form of attack was that? Was that an air attack?
It was the air attack. It was the air attack I described earlier.
The fast jets.
The jets, yeah, fast jets on our logistic base at Ajax Bay, and blew up there. On the pad were nets full of gun and mortar ammunition and linked belt waiting to be taken down to Para, and the whole lot was destroyed. So they had to get set to and redo it. He made a plan during the day and gave his orders that day. And the best person, I mean, you don't really want to talk to me about Goose Green in detail. Presumably you're going to talk to someone who was there. But they then kick off at about midnight and start what effectively is an advance to contact in darkness, which eventually becomes an advance to contact in daylight after they've overrun some of the earlier positions, during which they get pinned down and H is killed.
Did you have any notion of the general layout of the Argentinian positions and outposts?
No. Right. No, none whatever. Because the recces never got to, because they couldn't, beyond Darwin, and all the positions and in the Goose Green battle are further back.
So was Jones really effectively advancing to contact blind on his way down?
This is his plan. This is actual moves rather than the plan moves.
Yes.
But the way he took, A Company took Burnside House first. That was on the plan. Then he moved down like this with D and C on the right here. And C is patrols coming, D and B rather on the right, and C Company coming down the middle. C Company is the patrols company. A then gets in, takes Darwin like this, or is about to take Darwin, and they're going round like this because there's a little causeway there, and I don't know why they sent one platoon over that causeway and took the other two round that way, which seems rather funny, but that's what they did. They then had this battle on this line here. Yes. See, that line is actually a line of gorse on a hill, and the main Argentine positions were astride there, so you couldn't see any of that from here,
making use of the gorse as cover, presumably.
And that's where H is killed in the battles around here. And then, in fact, what actually happened was Chris Keeble is back with Maine, and he takes over. By the time he gets across onto the right-hand side, it's been sorted out by Johnny Crossland commanding B Company and Phil Neen commanding D, who then sort out. I mean, that's called Bocker House. Actually, it's just some ruins about that high. But there was quite a big Argentine position there, actually, which was covering the beach. Remember I talked about bringing landing
craft? You did, yes.
If you brought landing, you would have landed right under their noses there.
So they had a strong point.
They thought that we might come that way, so that was where they were.
What scale was that? Was that a platoon strong point?
No, they had a
whole company.
Yeah, a whole company.
And they presumably were dug in around the ruins.
They were dug in around the ruins. Yeah, they were. And these are forward slopes. They pinned these two companies down.
Yes.
The Argies had 0.5 Browning machine guns. We had nothing that was capable of direct fire to the same degree as they were, other than GPMGs. This is where the CVRT would have been marvellous, because the going here, remember I said that the going around the settlements was sort of trampled down.
Flat, yes.
Well, all this is very, it's not flat, it's like that, and a lot of the going is much better.
So it's firm, undulating
much
ground.
Much firmer, undulating ground.
It sounds ideal for CVRT, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's why I should have sent them. This gets resolved, actually. And then they start going to the airfield and coming down, and then they get pinned down on this slope here, which again is another of these forward slopes. By the way, they sorted this out by using Milan for the first time.
But against the Brownings.
Against the Brownings. Because Milan obviously had the range to engage them. And then Nipponin took D Company. There's a low cliff all along here, about that high.
Along the beach.
Along the beach. And they crept along the beach while B Company were, and then came in around the back, and they did a sort of two company attack.
So it's not flanking move, and then an attack from front and rear simultaneously.
Exactly.
Yes.
Without the benefit of the CO or 2IC, mm. who came up after mm. it was all over.
And the Argentines in the Bockenhaus position didn't interfere.
Well, their heads were kept down, and so it worked.
By the front company was.
Yeah. I think you need to talk to Phil and Johnny Crossland.
Indeed.
They'll tell you all about it.
Mm.
What was I going to say? Yes. Just as a matter of interest, what I did was I had an LO with the battalion on a radio net direct to me, mm. and the chap I chose was a chap called Hector Gullum, who was a two-para chap attached to my headquarters. I mean, he'd been attached long before this operation started. He was on an exchange, mm. and he was a very experienced chap. He'd commanded a squadron in the Dhofar. Mm. He'd also commanded the attack on the Iranian embassy. So he could read a battle in a way that a lot of other people couldn't. And he was keeping me in the picture, giving me really a running commentary on this battle mm. all the time. And he was terribly useful. I mean, what I should have done, in retrospect, is taken another unit down there, a commando down there, and my TAC with CVR team. We'd have been through this bloody place in about half an hour.
Mm. But you only had one commando in reserve, didn't you? You've got three
yeah.
para. And
no, I've got one in reserve. I've got
yes.
three para and 4-5 walking. I've got 4-2 commando and 40 commando city, so I could have taken one of them.
So you could have taken half your reserve and put that into
I could have taken
screen.
Half my reserve. Yeah. And in fact, as
but
this
at what point was it realised that there were three companies of enemy here rather than just one company? Presumably only after the Battle of the Gun.
Oh, only after the Battle of the Gun, and only really when you lined up these guys and started counting them.
So it would really have been to send two battalions against one company would have been rather an excessive.
Yeah.
It would not have conformed to economy of force, would it?
No, but what I think it would have done, I mean, all this is in hindsight.
Yeah, of course.
It would have been a very good sort of live firing, mm. field firing exercise mm. against a live enemy. It would have guaranteed a really quick success and have given everything, everyone a bloody good blow through.
Mm.
And, you know, that. I wish I'd done it. I now wish I'd done it. And these guys did it without any support from anybody because they started running out of ammunition from mortars and guns. The Bukharas shot down one of my helicopters going to pick up H because the message we got was that he was wounded mm. and to start Kazovac. The other helicopter evaded. So that closed down with the Bukharas ranging around here, the helicopter LSC.
So you couldn't resupply?
We couldn't resupply until we started doing it again. We took a risk on it and started moving forward again. This is the mortar line here and the gun line to begin mm. with. And they then moved to there. We'd asked for Harrier support, but the carriers were clagged in at sea. So there was no Harrier, and the mm. battalion ended up at the end of the day after fighting in for 14 hours here on the forward slope, pinned down by anti-aircraft guns firing in the ground roll there, firing back at them, against which they had no answer.
What sort of anti-aircraft?
They were, I think, 35mm Hispano Suiza. They were nasty bits of kit.
Light automatics.
Yeah, yes. they were very
were
nasty.
Were these single
pieces.
Barrel or quadruple barrel?
They were, I think they were single barrel, but there were about mm. five of them.
Yeah.
Three or four.
Yeah.
So, and there's nothing they could do about it.
Mm.
And at that stage, they were attacked by Pukharas, mm. one of which was shot down. And as the light was fading, the 7th Cavalry, in the form of three GR3s, arrived overhead. Having been able to get off for the first time that day, the primary FAC, who's an airman, had broken his ankle or something on the way down and had to be sent back. Luckily, the Naval Gunfire Support Forward Observer, NGFO, they're trained as FACs,
mm.
and he took the set off him, or took it, had taken it off him earlier, and he talked these Harriers down, and they sorted out this gun position.
Oh. Did they suffer any damage from the Hispano Suizas?
No.
They
were fired at.
They were lucky because they would have come in low, wouldn't they, to do the business?
Well, they did come, they did, but they were hit by something else. One of them was hit by something else.
Mm.
a chap called Bob Iverson, there were three Harriers, was hit by something else, and he had to eject, and he ended up over here alive and hiding. We picked him up a couple of days later, but but they came in and sorted these guys out, and then it was nightfall. So the battalion is now around here. At just before that, though, the Argentines landed two companies worth of guys here by helicopter. This is the strategic reserve I'm talking about.
Yes.
So here's two paras, just fought all night, all day. They've seen this. They then see
two more companies
arriving, who then rush in to support. It's not one company, this is an out-of-date map, it's two. And they run into the garrison, but they're not seen again.
What happened to them?
Well, they got taken prisoner the next day.
So there's no point in sending them.
I mean, it would have been if they'd done something with them. They were sort of paralysed by this air attack, I think.
And the psychological effect.
And that night, the battalion went firm around the airfield, and they learnt from the settlement manager of Darwin, who's of course now in our hands, as it were, that all the members of the settlement were locked up in the schoolhouse in Goose Green. And so Chris Keeble sent in a captured warrant officer, Argentine, with a note which had been written by Rod Bell, who I'd sent down to him as an interpreter, which said, you either surrender or tomorrow we'll hit you with air and artillery and smash you to pieces, and you'll be responsible for the deaths of all the civilians, by the way.
Wow. Now this is pure bluff, isn't it?
Pure bluff. It worked. And the next morning they surrendered.
And there were then what? Five companies of them.
And there were the remnants of the original three. A lot of them had been taken prisoner or killed, you see.
Crash.
So the most of the guys who had been here were off the board by then in somewhere or other. And these guys, you have two fresh companies plus all the airmen.
Were any of the airmen capable of fighting in the infantry role?
Well, I suppose they could have been, but they didn't. So it was quite a strong place, actually.
Yes. I mean, it looks as though they chose quite a good place to put their main line of defence, because it's got water on its flank.
Oh, sure.
And they've got good observation forward, and they have cover for their own position.
Absolutely.
So they weren't incompetent.
No, the ideas, they had good ideas for deployment, but not, frankly, good ideas for how they used them afterwards. You know, they weren't good at thinking on their feet.
So they lacked mental flexibility.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. And what state were the paras in then when they'd finally managed to persuade these people to
pretty knackered. I mean, they were in high spirits, and they'd done tremendously well, but they were quite knackered. I, by that time, actually, as I saw this progressing, I thought we'd better have something up our sleeve. So I'd told 4-2 commander to stand by to fly a rifle company down and support them. And they flew down the next day, and they were not needed, of course. But we had a lot of Harriers on standby to implement. I mean, Chris discussed this bluff with me.
How many Harriers had you got then?
By then we'd ordered six Harriers, and we were flying more guns and ammunition down.
How many 105s would you have had to
bring? By then we were flying down another three, so they had six 105s down there, plus ammunition.
Any chance of bringing naval gunfire to bear that?
Not during the day. The Navy wouldn't come anywhere near here during the day. I mean, the other thing I haven't mentioned is the Navy had provided a frigate to support the battalion, but in daytime they wouldn't be anywhere outside the San Carlos air umbrella. They wouldn't have frigates. They'd learnt their lesson with Arden being sunk here. They wouldn't bring down any.
Was there any notion at any time of doing this as a night attack?
Well, it started as a night attack.
Yes, but the daylight came up, didn't it?
The daylight came up. You know, we was hoped that it would be over. So it was Arrow who was in support.
Yes.
had to leave her gun line, though she stayed on for a bit longer. She also didn't help the fact that her turret, one of these single turret, single gun things, it broke down, jammed at some stage in the battle. So the fire support was pretty nugatory.
How did the Paras react to the loss of Jones? Was this a great blow to their...
I didn't think so. I mean, I didn't see a great sort of loss of morale, no. And I think they won a battle largely through their own efforts, and they were pleased to have done it that way.
What condition were the Argentines in? Did you see anything of them?
Oh, that's why I went down there and saw a lot of them. They looked all right. They were well fed and fit and perfectly okay. I mean, they were not in any bad condition at all.
Well, and what about their morale, their mental state?
Well, their morale was pretty low because they were looking a bit dejected, I thought.
Do you think they realised that they'd been suckered and that they could have held out?
I don't know.
What arrangements did you have for handling prisoners of war? Because you've now got quite a large number, haven't you?
It's a very good question.
A big bunch of 1,000 plus.
A very good question. How do you get all this lot back to the cage which you're setting up for them? The cage, incidentally, all the tents and wire and kit for the cage was sitting at the bottom of the sea in Atlantic Inver. So the only place you can put them is the logistic area, because you've then got sort of chaps who can look after them. In fact, what we used was, I had battle casualties sent out to me, battle casualty replacements. But they formed, as it were, my prisoner guard force until required to go in and replace battle casualties. So I thought, we'll make the buggers walk. And then somebody said, well, maybe they can't. They're incapable of getting there. How are you going to herd 1,500 prisoners along? Make certain they don't all escape.
Especially at night.
Disarm their guards, and, So the best answer is to use our precious helicopters to fly them back.
But 1,100 of them, that's an awful lot of...
Yeah, it took a long time. Mm. They were down there for a long time. And several days, as I remember. They were sort of shuffled back in packets. Mm. And they did various things for us, like showing us where their minefields were, clearing up ammunition. They had a lot of very unstable napalm in drop tanks. One lot of it burst into flames and burnt an Argentine as he was moving them around, and he was burning to death and screaming, so he was shot by a parachute soldier to put him out of his agony. They were quite a problem. You then had to feed them and minister them. Then you had an interrogation problem.
Well, you've got that. You've got the question of hygiene.
The housing, the whole
business.
We actually herded them originally into the sheep shearing sheds in Darwin.
Yeah.
And they've still got, if you go down there ever, they've still got POW painted on the side.
Yeah.
We did that so they wouldn't bomb their own prisoners.
Did you inform the Argentinians that this had happened, or was there...
Well, no, I didn't inform them. No, I mean, they knew they were going to surrender because they asked permission from Menendez to surrender, apparently.
And he agreed.
He said they weren't to.
Oh,
they
did?
They disobeyed him.
Now, normally, as far as I understand it, the construction and administration of prisoner of war cages is supposed to be a function of the Royal Pioneer Corps.
Correct. We didn't have any down there.
You didn't have any?
No. I mean, the arrangements for looking after prison walls were pretty rudimentary. Because most of the kit had gone to the bottom of the sea.
Mm.
And secondly, we didn't have enough people to look after them. And I think that's a feature of years and years of peacetime soldiering, where you don't have loads of prisoners.
No.
It's not something you practice on exercises.
No, but it is vitally important. Second World War, I think, similar circumstances, shall we say, in some ways, off the beaches of Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
The policy was get them out and away by sea as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And ships that have brought reinforcements in, were taking back wounded and POWs to England.
Yeah, well, we didn't have that luxury.
Mm.
And we actually did that right at the end when it was all over.
Yeah.
In that the Argentine prisoners were the first chaps to get home.
Mm.
The losers got home first, so they were all.